A positive mind finds a way things can be done. A negative mind looks for all the ways things can't be done. The secret is to be aware of the dominant operating mode of your mind and change it if necessary. It all depends on controlling your mental attitude.
How can one control mental attitude? Well, there are a good many ways of controlling it. First, by exercising the power of will directed to definite purposes based upon definite motives. If you give yourself a sufficient motive for wanting to attain an objective or do a certain thing, you'll have no trouble in controlling your mental attitude in connection with that one thing. It depends entirely upon your motive, how badly you want to do it. If your motive is not strong, the chances are you'll weaken when opposition comes along. And the more of those motives that are activated by, the stronger will be your application of the power of faith. Second, by keeping the mind charged with a burning desire for the attainment of definite objectives of a positive nature. Keeping your mind charged at all times. The mind is a peculiar piece of machinery. You know, it's something like a garden spot. I can't think of a better simile than this. It's something like a rich garden spot. And you've all perhaps lived at one time or another when there was a garden spot attached to the house or nearby where in the finest weeds on the farm would grow. Just didn't find weeds like them anywhere else. And also, you didn't have to cultivate the weeds. Wasn't that strange? You did have to cultivate the cabbages and the tomatoes and other things, but the weeds, you didn't have to cultivate them. You didn't even have to plant them. They planted themselves. The mind is like that rich garden spot. If you don't plant in it the things you want to grow out of it, and then keep the things that you don't want out, the things you don't want will take the place, just the same as they do in your garden spot. There's no two ways about it. It'll work that way. You've got to keep your mind so busy doing and thinking about the things you want that it has no time whatsoever to sprout these seeds of weeds that will grow there without your effort and without your want. In other words, keep your mind so busy getting the things you want that it has no time to think about the things you don't want. I think of all of the sins of human beings, the greatest sin is that of idleness, of allowing your mind to be idle, not doing anything at all, not working according to a plan. And next, by association with people who inspire active engagement in positive purposes and refusal to be influenced by negative people. In other words, choosing the right people and avoiding the influences of the wrong people. And next, a profound recognition of the importance of the one prerogative of the Creator, that is, that you possess complete control of the mind at all times, if you'll only exercise that. Now then, how important is mental attitude? Well, judging from what I've just been saying, you'd say it's very important. Well, I tell you that it's the main control over the power of faith. But here are some specific indications of how important mental attitude. First of all, your mental attitude is the major factor which attracts people to you or repels them. Did you ever think about that? Did you ever think that the people that are attracted to you are attracted to you not necessarily on account of what you do, nor on account of what you say, nor on account of what you look like? They're attracted to you on account of what you think. And you don't have to express it orally. You only have to think it in their presence. Of course, you can't just think a good thought in one's presence one time and then bad thoughts the next time. I mean the positive mental attitude that you express all of the time reaches to the people that you come into contact with, that you do business with. And it brings them back to do business with you over and over again, or it repels them, keeps them away, and you wonder, what happened to that man? He used to come down here and patronize him, he never comes in here anymore. I didn't disabuse him, I didn't say anything out of the way to him, I treated him nicely. But if you go back to the bottom of it all, you probably would find out that your mental attitude was not right. You were worried about something when you talked to him. You were out of step with somebody, maybe out of step with yourself. It reflects itself in your relationship with people. And next, mental attitude is a major factor in the maintenance of sound health. Had you ever thought about that? It really is. You allow yourself to be worried day in and day out and see how quick you'll come down with a cold or a flu or something worse. Your body resistance is destroyed by a negative mental attitude. A positive mental attitude supports and feeds that body resistance, the thing that nature has provided in you to keep you well and healthy at all times. I have never yet known a person who was sickly in any nature whatsoever that you couldn't trace that back very largely to a negative mental attitude. A positive mental attitude is the finest of all therapeutic agencies. All the doctors in the world cannot equal the importance of a positive mental attitude, and all of the better doctors of every school of therapeutics today recognize and make use of the necessity of helping the patient to maintain the right kind of a mental attitude toward the doctor and toward himself. Because you may be sure that the patient that does not have confidence in his doctor is not going to be benefited very much by that doctor, no matter who the doctor is and how much he knows. And next, your mental attitude is a determining factor as to whether you find peace of mind or go through life in a state of frustration and misery. Now, that's a determining factor, your mental attitude. You find peace of mind or you go through life in a state of frustration according to the extent to which you control and maintain the kind of mental attitude that you want. I don't know whether this impresses you the way it does me or not, but I think the most astounding thing in this whole universe consists in the fact that we know beyond any question of a doubt that the Creator gave man control over but one thing, not two things, but one thing, and that is his mental attitude. And surely the Creator intended that that was to be the most important thing in the world, and it is, because if you control your mental attitude, you control everything else within the sphere of life that you occupy. You're the dominating factor if you control your own mental attitude. Yet, the majority of people don't make any pretense of trying to control their mental attitude. They get mad at the drop of a hat. If a fellow doesn't drop the hat, they knock it off his head and then get mad. The next mental attitude is the very warp and the woof of all salesmanship, regardless of what you're selling. Yourself, services, merchandise, politics, religion, law, medicine, chiropractic, or whatever you're doing. You're selling something. We're all salesmen. Some of us, albeit, are not very good salesmen. We're very poor ones because we're selling in reverse gear instead of the third gear forward. It's the very warp and the woof of all salesmanship. And unless you condition your mind to make a sale, you'll never make one. Somebody may buy something from you because he happens to need it and he can't get it anywhere else. But you may be sure you didn't have anything to do with making the sale unless you were in the right mental attitude when you were negotiating that sale. It's an important factor in connection with your entire station in life, the job you hold, the pay you receive, and the entire space that you occupy in the world is dependent largely upon the mental attitude that you maintain. And you never can occupy very much space in the world unless that positive attitude is positive at all times. The man with a negative mental attitude occupies some space. He occupies just as little space, however, as people can get him into. They don't go out of their way to make space for him. You know that. Nobody likes a grouch. Nobody likes a man who's got something on his chest he wants to get off. Nobody likes a man who is disgruntled or has a gripe or has mean things to say about other people.
Enthusiasm is the action factor of thought. Enthusiasm is often confused with animated feeling. But you can't get enthusiasm from jumping up and down or running around. Real enthusiasm comes from within, influencing the subconscious mind to act promptly on your burning desires. And it generates enthusiasm on the part of others.
When you turn on your enthusiasm, you step up the vibrations of thoughts which go out from your brain so that they reach and affect other people more quickly. As a matter of fact, you can send out thoughts which have been so stepped up with silent enthusiasm that they will reach and influence other people to whom you direct your thoughts. This is a fact which has been known to psychologists for ages, and it is also known to most master salesmen who use this method to condition the minds of their prospective buyers before they ever talk with them. You must have observed that the enthusiasm is very contagious, that it engages the attention of those who come under its influence and causes them to respond in a similar spirit of enthusiasm. I once heard Andrew Carnegie say that if you turn loose one man who thought in terms of intense enthusiasm in an industrial plant employing thousands of people, this man's enthusiasm would very quickly reach and influence every person in the plant. And he said that it made not the slightest difference whether the enthusiasm was negative or positive, constructive or destructive. Then Mr. Carnegie went on to explain that in his selection of employees for promotion to bigger jobs, the first thing he looked for was a man's capacity to express himself in terms of intense enthusiasm.
He said that enthusiasm is one of the most important traits necessary for leadership. The most successful lawyers are not necessarily those who know most about the legal profession, but they are those who know how to influence courts and juries with their belief in their cases and have a great capacity for expressing themselves with enthusiasm. When you are introduced to another person, you have a marvelous opportunity to sell yourself favorably to that person by the extent of the enthusiasm you express in accepting the introduction. When you shake hands with another person, you have also a fine opportunity to make a favorable impression by the warmth of enthusiasm you put into that handshake. If there is anything which leaves me flat and unfavorably impressed when I'm introduced, it's an extended hand which feels like a piece of cold ham and acknowledges the introduction with a cold, canned, pleased to meet you, with no signs of enthusiasm back of it. Right here, let me give you a brief course in salesmanship, which may be of value to you the remainder of your life. When you meet anyone on whom you wish to make a favorable impression, when it is a stranger you have not previously met, or someone with whom you are already acquainted, do these things. 1, turn on your enthusiasm, and so modulate your voice with it that you definitely make the other person feel you are happy to communicate with him. 2, when you shake his hand, take a firm grip on it and give it a quick, firm squeeze at the end of each word you express in your greetings. For example, say, "How do you do? I am so very glad to meet you." Do not crush the hand, however, as I have known some people to do. 3, then if you begin the conversation, be sure that you direct it to some subject of interest to the other person. And 4, follow through by eagerly asking questions which will keep attention focused upon the other person. Then, when you are ready to have the other person hear what you have to say about yourself or your interests or your business, he will have been prepared to listen attentively. For many years, I taught master salesmanship, and the first important thing I endeavored to teach my students was the importance of 1, speaking with enthusiasm, and 2, selling the prospective buyer himself before trying to sell him anything else. I've often told my students of salesmanship that the best possible way for one to sell himself to others is to first sell the others to themselves. That counsel was sound when I began training salesmen over 30 years ago, and it is still sound. When I was a youngster in school, I discovered that the teachers from whom I learned most were those who expressed the greatest enthusiasm in their teaching. And I have heard an experienced doctor say that the enthusiasm he carries into the sick room with him has more to do with helping to bring about a cure than all the medicine he can prescribe. And now, let me give you another interesting sidelight on the effects of enthusiasm. I have noticed that enthusiasm not only influences others who come under its effect, but it also very distinctly influences and benefits those who follow the habit of expressing it in their thoughts and deeds. Enthusiasm is an expression of a positive mental attitude, and it has long been known to doctors that a positive mental attitude stands high on the list of influences which give one sound health. I suggest that a very practical way to begin learning to express yourself with enthusiasm will be to follow the habit of reading aloud for 10 minutes daily, putting all the enthusiasm at your command into your reading. You will be surprised in a short while at how much this will help you in speaking with enthusiasm in your ordinary conversations. I would suggest also that you adopt the habit of practicing enthusiasm in your conversations with your family and your business associates. Incidentally, this habit will make you more popular with those who are close to you. You can enjoy the benefits of enthusiasm if you are interested enough to develop a technique by which to acquire this habit so you will follow it in a natural, unaffected tone of voice. If you follow my suggestion that you read for 10 minutes daily as a means of acquiring the habit of enthusiasm, I recommend that you write down a list of 10 subjects, things, or circumstances in which you have the keenest interest, and use this list for your practice purposes.
Never let a day pass without devoting time to the habit of enthusiasm and the furthering of your plans. Practice speaking with enthusiasm before a mirror. If you meet with any sort of unpleasant circumstance, repeat your definite major purpose in life with great enthusiasm. Repeat it over and over until negative feeling is replaced by positive feeling. Controlled enthusiasm can have rich and certain rewards. Remember that autosuggestion is a powerful factor in the development of the habit of enthusiasm. So keep yourself sold on the belief that you'll obtain your definite major purpose, no matter how far removed it may be. Your mental attitude will determine the action your subconscious mind will take in connection with the fulfillment of your purpose. And keep your mind positive at all times. Enthusiasm thrives on positive thought and action. The subconscious mind can also be enlisted in the practice of creative vision or imagination. This creative vision may be inborn, or it may be an acquired quality. It can be developed by the use of two types of imagination, as Dr. Hill explains.
One, there is synthetic imagination, consisting of a combination of recognized ideas, concepts, plans, or facts arranged in a new combination. Basically, new things or ideas are but rarely discovered. Nearly everything known to and used by modern civilization is only a combination of something that is old. And two, there is creative vision operating through the sixth sense and having its base in the subconscious section of the brain, where it serves as the medium by which basically new facts or ideas are revealed. Now, one of the strange features of creative vision consists in the fact that it seldom operates unless it is quickened and inspired through a burning desire or some very definite and intense motive. First, as an example of the use of synthetic imagination, let us take the case of Thomas A. Edison's invention of the incandescent electric lamp. You may recall I told you on a previous program that Edison failed in more than 10,000 separate experiments before he finally uncovered the two simple ideas which, when combined, gave the world its first incandescent electric light. Now, you see, he was using synthetic imagination, putting together old ideas in a new way. Then, almost by mere chance, Edison resorted to the use of creative vision and got the answer to his problem in a matter of minutes. He had spent the entire day searching for the answer when he became exhausted and laid down for one of those 15-minute catnaps for which he was so famous. Just as he awoke, the elusive thing for which he had been searching through 10,000 failures flashed into his mind. It consisted of one of the two factors which went into the building of the incandescent electric lamp. He already had discovered one of these factors, namely that by applying electrical energy to both ends of a wire so as to form a short, the wire would heat up until it made a light. But the trouble was that the wire would also burn up almost instantly.
The second factor was something known to man since the discovery of fire. It just took Thomas Edison's subconscious to help him connect it for an invention that was to change the world.
It was the simple principle by which charcoal is produced. By setting a pile of wood on fire, covering it over with dirt, and allowing the heat to smolder until the wood is slowly burned into what is known as charcoal. You know that where there is no oxygen, there can be no combustion. Where there is but little oxygen, as in the case of that which percolates through the dirt, it slowly burns the wood into a charcoal. When this thought flashed into Mr. Edison's mind, he rushed back to his laboratory, placed a bent piece of wire into a bottle, pumped all the air out and sealed the bottleneck, then applied the electrical energy to the protruding ends of the wire, and lo, the world's first incandescent electric lamp was born. Born of two simple ideas brought together in a new way. Naturally, the wire couldn't burn up quickly because no oxygen was reaching it, therefore no combustion. He hadn't used creative vision because he had not yet discovered it. But from there on out, Edison began to put the law of creative vision to work, and it helped him uncover more of nature's secrets than had been uncovered by all mankind up to that time. The invention of the incandescent electric lamp ushered in the great electrical age, which has been extended until it is an indispensable part of our entire system of economy. It has not only earned hundreds of billions of dollars in material riches and provided jobs to hundreds of thousands of people, but look what it has done to lighten the physical labor of all mankind. It is worthy of note that when the great overseer turns loose an idea in this world, it may become a part of the plan behind the entire universe.
One of the features of creative vision is that it seldom operates unless it is inspired through a burning desire or a very definite and intense motive. When it's combined with synthetic imagination, the results can be spectacular.
A good illustration is the case of Orville and Wilbur Wright, who built and flew the first flying machine. Previously, no one had flown a heavier-than-air machine. But the Wright brothers kept on experimenting through the application of synthetic imagination until at long last the law of creative vision was revealed to them. Then they built the machine in which they made their first flight. Incidentally, you may be interested to know that the phonograph, or talking machine as it was originally called, was the only strictly basic invention that Thomas A. Edison ever created. All his other patents were revealed through a combination of synthetic imagination and creative vision. The idea for the talking machine flashed into Edison's mind out of thin air, as he described it, and he went to work right where he stood and made a rough drawing of the first model, produced the machine, tried it out, and it worked from the very first trial.
There are several specific ways you can stimulate your own creative vision. Here, Dr. Hill gives you the key points in developing this principle for success.
First, get on good terms with your own conscience by following its dictates always. Then, stop selling yourself short and begin developing a belief in your capacity to do anything you desire to do. And keep your mind so busily engaged in getting the things and creating the circumstances you want that it will have no time to worry about that which you do not want. Find out who you are, what you want from life, what you have to give in return, and then back yourself with everything you have. Whet your imagination to a keen edge by keeping it everlastingly busy on something over which you can develop an obsessional desire. Obsessional, that is, not merely hopeful wishing. And be at least as good to your physical body as you are to your automobile by seeing that it gets the right sort of fuel and upkeep and the proper cleansing from the inside. Stop burdening yourself with fear and worry. Then set aside a silent hour when you will be still and listen for guidance through the small voice which speaks from within. Thus you may discover and appropriate the greatest of all powers, the power of creative vision. Creative vision is not the product of hustle and bustle and fear and worry and anxiety and greed. It is the product of meditation and silence and prayer.
Controlled attention is the act of coordinating all the faculties of the mind and directing their combined power to a given end. Control is the key to this thought power. Attention that is not controlled and directed may be nothing more than idle curiosity.
Success in all the higher brackets of individual achievement is attained by the application of thought power, properly organized and directed to definite ends. And power, whether it be thought power or physical power, is attained by concentration of energy. The greatest of all forms of thought power is that which is developed by the application of the mastermind principle. For here, the power of many individual minds may be concentrated upon the attainment of any given object. The scientist concentrates his mind upon the search for the hidden facts and secrets of nature, and lo, the combined powers of the universe seem to conspire to reveal them to him. Military men concentrate upon organized warfare, and through their search for new and more effective weapons of warfare, they uncover new and better means of production in industry, new formula in chemistry, physics, biology, psychology, and many other shortcuts to desirable ends in the business of living. And concentration of military power at a given point is the means of major importance by which victories are gained. In business and in industry, the principle of concentration is the keynote of success. William Wrigley, Jr. concentrated upon the manufacture of a 5-cent package of chewing gum and lived to see the entire nation of people take up the habit of chewing gum, not to mention the fortune he accumulated for his efforts.
F.W. Woolworth concentrated upon the operation of 5- and 10-cent stores and accumulated a great fortune from the sale of gadgets and trinkets in the low-price field of merchandise. John D. Rockefeller concentrated upon the refining and sale of oil, and he made it yield him a fortune sufficient for the needs of 10,000 men. Henry Ford concentrated upon the manufacture and distribution of a low-priced, dependable automobile and became the directing head of one of America's greatest industrial enterprises. Edgar Bergen concentrated upon a block of wood called Charlie McCarthy and made it bring him fame and fortune far beyond his ordinary needs. Andrew Carnegie concentrated upon the manufacture and sale of steel and remained steadfast in his purpose until he ushered in the Great Steel Age, which was destined to change for the better the living habits and the standard of living of the people of an entire nation. His efforts yielded him more money than he could give away during his lifetime. Charles Darwin concentrated upon the principle of evolution, and his efforts brought enlightenment through the revelation of facts which stepped up education and general human progress 1,000 years or more. Wilbur and Orville Wright concentrated upon the building of airplanes and lived to see the product of their brains become the master of the air. Thomas A. Edison concentrated upon scientific invention, and though he was practically without formal education, he lived to see the products of his brain serve mankind in no less than 100 different ways, and to him the world is indebted for the great electrical age, which has improved the entire American way of life by lessening the labors of men. Henry J. Kaiser concentrated upon the building of ships to fill the emergency needs of a country at war. And though he had never built ships before, he concentrated on his job so effectively that he amazed the entire shipbuilding industry by his speed and efficiency, excelling, as he did, the efforts of men who had been engaged in shipbuilding all of their lives. Last but not least, the Nazarene concentrated upon the task of teaching men how to live with one another in peace and harmony. And though his efforts have not yet reached their intended climax, his teachings have become the greatest single influence this world has ever known. Concentration on one's major purpose projects a clear picture of that purpose upon the subconscious section of the mind and holds it there until it is taken over by the subconscious and acted upon. Thus we see that prayer may be expressed by concentration on a definite objective by the strictest habits of self-discipline through these factors. Definiteness of purpose, which is the starting point. Imagination, through which the object of one's purpose is illuminated and mirrored in the mind so clearly that its nature cannot be mistaken. The emotion of desire, turned on until it attains the proportion of a burning desire that will not be denied fulfillment. Faith in the attainment of the purpose, attained by a belief in the realization which is so strong that one can see himself already in possession of it. The full force of the willpower applied continuously in support of faith. The subconscious section of the mind picks up the picture thus conveyed to it and carries it out to its logical conclusion by whatever means that may be available according to the nature of the purpose. These are some of the factors which enter into the principle of concentration, and they embrace the procedure followed in all prayers that produce positive results. If any of these factors is missing in prayer, the results are apt to be negative and therefore disappointing. Effective concentration requires that one's attention be fully controlled and directed to a definite objective. Controlled attention is the act of coordinating all the faculties of the mind and can be attained only by the strictest sort of self-discipline. As a matter of fact, one cannot control the attention and direct it to a given end without the supporting influence of well-developed habits of thought, and these are attainable only by self-discipline. Therefore, it is obvious that all the previously mentioned principles of this philosophy blend with and become a part of the principle of concentration. If you have mastered those principles described previously, and you have followed all the instructions given, you are now ready to take complete charge of your mind power, and you may direct it to whatever ends you desire with reasonable assurance that you will not fail. That is controlled attention. It is not the burden of this philosophy to suggest to anyone the nature or purpose of that which he should desire. The Creator reserved no such prerogative as this, but he provided every person with the privilege of directing his thoughts and desires to ends of his own choice. Therefore, reason and common sense impel us to follow that example. However, we can state with emphasis born of a great deal of faith, that controlled attention places one in the way of attaining the master key to the power of the mind, that it may help one to take full and complete control of his mind, that it is a scientific method of contacting and drawing upon the great reservoir of infinite intelligence for the supply of all human needs. We believe in these truths because we have seen them demonstrated under a great variety of circumstances, embracing almost every type of human progress.
You can harness the power of controlled attention if you know precisely what you desire to attain. Then saturate your mind with it. You need to give this desire precedence over all other thoughts. Bring it to mind repeatedly by mastermind discussions and your own individual thinking. If you use controlled attention, you can impress your desires and purposes on your subconscious mind, where they will become part of your character. You must take possession of your mind and direct it toward the attainment of your definite major purpose, or your mind will take possession of you and give you whatever the circumstances of life hand out. If you want true success in your life, you are well on the way to achieving it. Remember to listen frequently to these recordings. It's inevitable that with each exposure, you'll find a new insight or understanding. And it's these flashes of insight that can lead to greatness. We'll close our program with a prayer that helped Napoleon Hill through many challenges, and a tip about remaining energetic and youthful.
I remain young by keeping busy in a labor of love, and by the habit of celebrating every birthday by taking off a year from my age instead of adding one. And I'm now back in my late 30s. But perhaps to speak more seriously, I close each day's labor with a prayer which keeps my store of blessings eternally filled, and I shall express that prayer now. O infinite intelligence, I ask not for more riches, but for more wisdom with which to make better use of the blessings with which I was endowed at birth, through the privilege of embracing my own mind and directing it to ends of my own choice. Amen.
This has been a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.